This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 216 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
We are thrilled to welcome Sarah Fraser to the Outlander podcast. And so we can explain her connection to our show and, of course, the show we all love. Sarah Fraser lives in the Highlands, where she's been for the past 30 years after marrying and then divorcing, then marrying again into the Fraser clan. She educated her children in Gaelic and has a PhD in bawdy Gaelic poetry. Her husband's real-life ancestor is the fictional character Jamie Fraser's grandfather, the actual last Highlander described in her story. A huge Outlander podcast welcome to Dr. Sarah Fraser.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm so happy to be with you.
Oh, it's our pleasure. It's our pleasure. After looking at your work, it's... I don't read Gaelic yet. I vow to one day, maybe not fluently, but at least have a working knowledge of it. I would love to read your thesis. because that sounds... If you have a PhD in bawdy Gaelic poetry, then you must be familiar with Dr. Michael Newton.
Yes, I am, yes. I mean, I did, the poet I translated, or his bawdy verse, first of all, he was a minister in the church, and second, he was the Jacobite who taught Bonnie Prince Charlie his Gaelic, the Gaelic he knew. He's called Alexander MacDonald. So it's quite
that's fantastic.
Right? If you want some ginger, you just give me, I'll email it to you.
Oh, that would be perfect. I jest not, I promise. I jest not. Okay, well, Sarah, thank you so much for joining us. This is fantastic. Before we get into your book, the biography of Simon Fraser, the old fox, Simon Fraser of Lovat, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to be part of the Frasers and how you came to study Gaelic, of all things.
I know. I mean, it's so weird in a way, because I'm an outlander, basically. I've got three Irish grandparents and I've got an English one. And I came to Scotland 34 years ago to marry a Fraser. And it was very eccentric. There was no money at all. So my father-in-law was constantly terrified that the castle would fall down with dry rot. And he wouldn't shut the doors. And I mean, you know, it's cold. And I was from the south of England. And I thought, bloody hell, what am I going to do? And you would wake up with ice on the inside of your windows. And one night the roof leaked and my mother-in-law came and got me and she said, oh, Sarah, you must come and look at this. And there were icicles like stalactites hanging down the spiral staircase. And I thought, I am in a different world. But we had four children. And as you said, I put them through Gaelic medium education because I just wanted them to know that wherever they wandered in the world, this was their roots. They knew what their roots were. And it was that really that took me also into my PhD, because I thought, well, one of us really should be pretty fluent in Gaelic if possible. And I went to learn it and I got intrigued by this verse that was kind of below the radar, as it were.
Ah, so that was how you, that was kind of your entry into, into wanting to find out more and then leading to your PhD.
Yes, it was. It was. But then after that, I thought, well, actually, university lecturing is not for me. I was a mum and a mother of four by then, and it just wasn't possible. I had four children under six. But I always knew about this story of Lovat of the 45, the old fox. There are pictures. We've got Hogarth prints of him on the walls. And a cousin said, now that would make a good book. And I thought, well, flipping heck, I want to write that book. And I I sent a pitch into HarperCollins and they accepted. So I thought, and it's a hell of a story. I mean, whoa, what a character.
Truth is stranger than fiction. You can't write a better Hollywood story than his life was.
No, I think so. I think that's right. I mean, he was, yes, he was a complicated, twisted character, but life made him that. I mean, Simon should never have been the chief. He was the second son of a second son, and a series of deaths, which were fortuitous for him. You know, like his older brother died in the first Jacobite uprising of 1688, when King James Stuart II was fled the throne, and that was the birth of Jacobitism. So Simon's story is tied in with this whole Jacobite odyssey right from the beginning. And Simon became his father's heir. So that got him one step nearer the top of the clan. And then his cousin died without a male heir. And that made Simon the male heir. And he was the heir. And things in some ways couldn't have been better. I mean, it was a tragic path to the top, but he was there by hereditary right.
Now, you mentioned the beginning of Jacobitism and you mentioned the 45. So I was going to say two things, but when you got into Jacobitism, I think that's a good place to start. So yes, absolutely, Simon Fraser was involved in the Jacobite Rising of 1745. However, something I did not know, and you just alluded to, he was also directly, or at least in some capacity, involved with all three, or around during all three Jacobite uprisings. So could you tell our listeners briefly, and I was happy to learn from your book, what exactly, how Jacobitism, how that word, how that definition began. Could you briefly explain to our listener who has heard of this term Jacobite, but really doesn't know how far back it stretches and where it comes from?
Yeah, it basically starts in 1688 when James II flees the throne, or the thrones of Great Britain, because he is a Catholic and he is going to have a Catholic heir. His name in Latin, James in Latin, is Jacobus. And the short form of Jacobus is Jack, you know, like Union Jack. Our flag, the Union Jack, is short for Jacobus. And Jacobite comes from Jacobus. That's what it is. It just means followers of James in Latin, basically. And you're right, Simon the phrases were always right from the beginning in 1688. They were instinctive Jacobites because they believed in the hereditary right. You know that there's something about kingship that is sacred, it's divinely ordained. And they thought that about clanship as well. The head of a clan was born to it, and it was your right to claim the chieftainship. And just as the Stuarts fled the thrones of Britain, so Simon was being forced out of the chieftainship of Clan Fraser. These two things are his huge formative influences.
Simon Fraser was educated at home, as many or most aristocratic or well-off children or families educated their children, and he had a tutor, and he later attended the University of Aberdeen. Now, that surprised me. I don't know why it surprised me, because today, you know, Prince William went to St. Andrews, happened to be there the same time I was there. So I don't know why it surprised me, but it did. So he didn't seem to love his time there, but he earned an MA in philosophy. And though he wasn't very fond of this time, it proved very helpful later in his life, you write. So could you describe how the skills he learned or honed at university helped him as clan chieftain and later a would-be diplomat and double dealer?
Yeah, sure. It was convention to send the gentlemen, Highland gentlemen, to universities. And if you look in the university rolls of Aberdeen, there his brother is, and there he is, and there some of their cousins and neighbours are enrolled in the 1670s. And he did a general degree taught in Latin and Greek. So he was multilingual in French, Italian, English, Latin, Greek. The course was very mixed. It involved, as you say, philosophy. He learned about the Renaissance philosophers like Machiavelli, that the ends justify the means. That's going to come in very handy for him later in life. He also undertook a course in civil law, which is all to do with property rights and inheritance struggles. And I think he quite consciously decided to undertake that course because he could see the direction of travel in the clan, in that his weak clan chief, who was his cousin Hugh, and at that time alive, had no surviving male heirs, but he had some very, very powerful in-laws in Mackenzie's and Murray's. And they effectively had been running the clan through Hugh. And they'd been getting quite used to this. I mean, the Mackenzie lands border the Fraser lands and the Murray lands are just to the south. And they can go and trade on this control of Clan Fraser with the king and say, look, we'll control the Highlands. We'll keep them quiet. They'll pay their taxes. We'll produce soldiers. If you turn a blind eye, basically, to the fact we're carving up Clan Fraser between us. And by about 1700, had it not been for Simon Fraser of Beaufort, Clan Fraser was on the point of going under. So, you know, that point when Jamie does not swear allegiance to Clan Mackenzie in the first series, that would have been an utter irrelevance. He would more or less have been a Mackenzie by then, if it wasn't for his wicked old grandfather.
Oh, fascinating. I love what you did there. You brought in Outlander as a matter of course. And that, I know, that is something that our listeners will absolutely love. So any opportunity, if you want to make a link to the story, please feel free. So Simon Fraser is this is something also that was, constant, but throughout his life, he was known as someone who liked the ladies and even those who may not have liked him. One of the most scandalous tales, of course, is the account of him and his first wife, Lady Amelia. Tell us about that.
Well, this is all tied up with his attempt to claim the chieftainship of the clan. And I mean, clan chiefs had to be men in those days. The women were very powerful. You know, I've read articles about, oh, surely Claire Randall Fraser would have been locked up for being basically a loudmouth lunatic. You know, a woman who talks out this much must be mad. But she wouldn't at all. Clanship could embrace feisty women. If you've got men running off to clan feuds and wars the whole time, you've got to leave strong matriarchs at home. So she would have been welcomed in clanship. But she might have argued with her grandfather-in-law, because what he did in order to assert his right to the chieftainship of Clan Fraser, he forced a marriage with the late chief's widow. When his cousin Hugh dies, he leaves little heiresses, but he doesn't leave a male heir. And the natural thing to do is to marry the female heiress off to the nearest male heir. And that's our Simon. So up he steps and presents himself, first of all, to the young heiress, who's about 10. Well, the Murrays react by kidnapping her and taking her to Perth. So actions speak louder than words there. They're going to keep this Fraser out. He is interfering in their plans. So what he does is he gallops over to Castle Downey, or Beaufort, it's called both, and he forces a marriage with his cousin's widow, who he knows pretty well. She doesn't want anything to do with him because she is independent and running the clan at that time. But they say that a parson was called for and the bagpipe blown up to cover her screams of refusal to marry Simon. It doesn't do her any good. He forces a consummation on her. And by the next day, they are very solidly man and wife. And the whole Mackenzie-Murray clan axis goes up like a volcano. I mean, they are not going to take this lying down. She is related to crowned heads of Europe, the Lady Lovett, Lady Amelia Murray, now Lady Lovett. She is a marquess's daughter. Her brother is effectively, they call him the Viceroy of Scotland. He is extremely powerful, and he's going to sort Simon Fraser and the Frasers out. And he basically raises an old style clan feud and goes after him and charges him with outlawry and treason.
So once he's married, once he's married, related to him being in his involvement, or at least his activity around the time, just before, just around the time of the first Jacobite Rebellion, Simon Fraser also left Scotland to go to France. Could you tell us why he left Scotland after Queen Anne, which would have been one of James' Protestant daughters, once she acceded the throne? Why did Simon leave?
Well, he sort of had to, because, as I say, Lord Murray was sitting high in the government's favour. And after the first Jacobite Rebellion, and there are other things leading on from that, like the massacre of Glencoe, you know, they wanted to pacify the Highlands first time round, first attempt. And she allowed Lord Murray to raise a government regiment to pursue Simon for outlawry. Because what he would do, once a government regiment's coming after him and a mixture of Murray clansmen, Murray's very clever. What he cloaks is his private vendetta in the kind of guise of keeping the peace for the government. So what he's really doing is pursuing a clan feud against Simon Fraser for the forced marriage with his sister and the thwarting of the Murray-Mackenzie carve-up of Clan Fraser. So he goes after Simon. He doesn't get him, but he gets his sister. And she refuses to... she refuses, interestingly, to testify against her errant husband, who by now has had to flee. And they have, they bring a law case, a lawsuit against Simon in Edinburgh. And they try him in absentia and, not surprisingly, find him guilty. And he is outlawed. His property, his title rights, his life, and anyone associated with him is forfeit and is liable to be executed. And Simon flees after James II and his wife and his baby Catholic son, who will be Bonnie Prince Charlie's father. And he flees after them to France, where they've sought refuge with James II's first cousin, Louis XIV, the Sun King, the most powerful king in the known world. And Louis XIV has given the Jacobites a home just outside Paris. And that's how Simon ends up there. He goes there because he has no choice. He's a man on the run. And he's a young man. I mean, he's barely 20. He's done a lot in his short life. Oh, boy. I mean, you know, when you despair of your own sons, you think, well, phew, could be worse. And he goes, so he ends up in France and he becomes one of those Jacobite conspirators who starts to plan to put the Jacobite, the Stuart male kings, back on the throne. And in that, he sees his own restoration to his estates. So his whole odyssey is tied up with this Stuart plunge for the thrones of their ancestors, this constant push to try and get back to the United Kingdom.
So it's so interesting because we're going to see that theme, because listeners who have read the books or watched the television series on Starz will know about the 45. Well, at least they'll know of what the show talks about in season 2. If they've watched season 3, which is episodes 1 and 2 have aired at least in the US now, they will know how that battle how that battle ended. But it's funny in a very tragic, in such tragedy. You have to give it to the Scots and the Jacobites for not giving up, because, oh, yes, I understand that not all of them who were involved in the 45 were around in 1688 or 89. But we're already seeing this pattern of, in the books too, because obviously we have our hero and heroine, but we're seeing this pattern of a threat from the South, a threat from government troops, and someone or some people fleeing to France to try and garner support, arms, troops, anything, or at least to scheme with the support in some fashion of the French monarchy, a monarch, and then ending up returning this plan for this uprising, and then a return to Scotland. Meanwhile, there's already been fighting, and we know how each time it turned out, but it seems to have repeated itself those three times.
Yes, it did. It did. And they had a great opportunity in 1715, which was the rebellion that should have worked. That one should have worked because when Queen Anne Stuart, the last of the Stuarts, dies, the obvious heirs are her half-brothers and his children, who are James III and his son, Bonnie Prince Charlie. And what happens is, I mean, even in England, the people are sick to death of governments tossing rulers on and off the throne, Stuarts on, Stuarts off, Stuarts on, Stuarts off, you know, without really reference to the people. They don't want a Catholic monarchy, but they have this loyalty to their hereditary heirs, the rightful heirs. And civil unrest breaks out even in England in about 80 towns. And in Scotland, the Earl of Mar agrees to lead the 1715 uprising. Simon Fraser at this time, Jamie's grandfather, is in France, and he is in a kind of house arrest because Louis XIV, I mean, you can't keep a good or a bad man down. He has been just too lively by half, Simon, constantly trying to stir up French-backed invasions to get home. And in the 15, the Earl of Mar raises the royal standard in Scotland, waiting for James III to come back from France. And they have to have French backing all the time. And you pick that up through, naturally, series 2 and also really in the beginning of series 3, where are the French? Where are the French? It won't work without substantial backing from a foreign power, the biggest foreign power in Europe at the time. And they make good use of that. They need it. Historically, they need it. And they make good use of it in the series. This, of course, what they're trying to do is stop the rebellion in series 2. But the French involvement is key to all of this. And Simon Fraser, Jamie Fraser's grandfather, sees this clearly. And he tries to get Louis to invade England, to support an uprising in Scotland and distract the English all the time. But really, By 1715, France has just declared peace after its long war with another long war with England, and he isn't going to do it. So Simon Fraser basically escapes and flees back to Scotland to try and make his peace with the government. He's constantly offending the authorities and then trying to make peace with them to let him get home. That's all he wants. He wants to get home and be the chief of Clan Fraser. And he will do anything to get there. Diana calls him the fox. And he was called in his lifetime the old fox. You know, he was cunning. He was cunning as a fox, but he was brave as well. But life was not easy for him. He could not take a straight path.
Well, one of the things I noticed from the series is that even though she did kind of paint him as not really a villain, like a pseudo villain, like he was kind of not a hero, really. He was never painted as a hero. But she did begrudgingly feel respect for him. Like you could tell in the way that she wrote him, and even the way he was dealt with in the series, there was begrudging respect that they felt for this character, even, you know, the fictionalized version of him.
I think that the way I sort of read it from the series is that she knows he is, and she granted him that he was very powerful and very intelligent and very cunning, a very worldly man. And he has done some terrible things. He has, you know, he forced that marriage on Lady Amelia Murray Lovett. He has betrayed people. There is this goal, and he doesn't get distracted from it, but he doesn't much mind what he does on the path. He's a Machiavellian character. You know, we were talking earlier, he read about Machiavelli, the ends justify the means at university. And that comes right through history and is also true in the books. He's Machiavellian. You know that the the episode in series two where he is weighing up whether to join the 45 or not. And he did do that. He weighed it up. He had kept peace in his area of the Highlands for 30 years by then. He has so much to lose, and he's an old man. He's actually in his late 70s. Apologies to Clive Lewis, who's nothing like that. But, you know, he's, you know, obviously. But Lover is an old man by then. And, oh, the emotional pull towards the Stuarts is huge. It's a head and heart thing, I guess. His heart would go out tomorrow. Bonnie Prince Charlie offers Lovett the leadership of the Jacobite forces. He knows he's such a powerful figure in the Highlands. He'll take the Highlands with him. But his head is saying, don't do it. You know, don't do it because you have so much to lose. And you know, it may not work again, as we know.
You hinted at it a little earlier about when he, when it was in France and then trying to get back home, and how you said he would do anything or say anything to the authorities. He was just wanting to get back to his home and be that chief. When he began, and correct me if I'm wrong, but he had a lifetime full of, he was one of the things he was known for, even to this day, and Diana brings it out, was his double dealings. And he was, and that is 100%, you said it, you diffused that down to, he would do anything he had to do, I think, for his own safety. I mean, I think that's fair to say, but also that he survived. But it was not so that he could survive and live off, you know, in La La Land. It was so that he could survive and lead his clan.
Yes, that's true.
So in this lifetime of double dealings, that kind of seemed to start, at least in history, start when around the time when his first time to France, I guess in 89, in 1689, when he fled to France to garner support from the Sun King. And then he went back to back to Scotland. And at that time he was outing. He's like, look, this is what the French are going to do.
Yeah.
He's like, so it seemed like, and I know it was to better, not to better himself, to try and get the best possible position for himself and his clan, and for him to have the best outcome for himself and his clan. But tell us a little bit more about this lifetime of double dealings.
Yes, he is totally indefensible in that way. I'll come clean to both of you right now on that one. I only try and bring him to life. I try not to sit in judgment on him. I mean, lots of people have sat in judgment on him. The first book I read on him, the opening line was, "Seldom has a more horrible old man met a more justified end." And I thought, oh, it can only go up from here on in. But yes, he was a double agent. And he was, what he would do was he went back. There was an amnesty being offered for outlawed Jacobites around the turn of the century and around the early 1700s. And he went back and he made contact with the Queen Anne's man in Edinburgh, the Duke of Queensberry. And he said he would reveal the names of Jacobite conspirators if Queensberry could get him a pardon. I mean, at the same time, of course, being Simon, that he is conspiring with Louis XIV to invade and get rid of Queen Anne. So he is doing both of those things. He's a rogue. Yep, he's a rogue. He definitely is. But he's fun to write about. I tell you what, you'd have wanted to sit next to him at dinner, but you would not ever have wished to have been his daughter or his wife or his girlfriend. Never, never. You wouldn't want to be intimate with him, but he's probably very entertaining over a bottle of wine. Yeah, he's awful. But he's fun, isn't he? Come on.
He's fantastic to read about.
Yeah, he's a worthy grandfather, don't you think? I mean, you know, for Jamie Fraser, he is a worthy grandfather, even if he is completely uncontrollable.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, he goes back. But he has to come down on one side or the other in the end. And in 1715, he comes down on the government side and he becomes a grand Highland chief in the old style. You know, he's got government positions. He's the sheriff of Inverness. He rules from Castle Downey with the power of pit and gallows over his clan. They call him Mac Shimi Mort, the son of the great Simon. They don't speak English, you know, within 4 miles outside Inverness. The government needs people like Simon to control the Highlands because they come up speaking English and they they really don't understand what's going on 5 miles outside the town. You know, Inverness is the capital of the Highlands. And so they need these men who are brokers, really, of peace and intelligence, like Simon, like Lovat of the 45, who'll say, don't worry, I'll manage the situation. You give me some money and a perk and a position, and I will manage the Highlands for you. And they're jostling for slices of the political cake. It's all about power as well.
And this is his position, or this is his state the next approximately 30 years.
Mm, correct. Yes, yes. That's when we see him, when we meet him in the series, you can see where a lot of this kind of Mackenzie Fraser antagonistic background's coming from, or I can, of course, because I know it quite well. But that's the man you're looking at. You're looking at a man who has got enormous experience and someone who is sitting at right at the top of Scottish society and is one of the men competing for positions in the government of Scotland on behalf of, and it's quite new, this new United Kingdom, of course, because we've had the Union in 1707, which Lovat hates it. He calls it cette union infernelle, this infernal union. He thinks that Scotland loses its pride and status when it becomes part of the Union, and he would break it if he could. But yeah, it's this man. So he's a very complicated, worldly, well-travelled rogue, double agent, but also Machiavellian, power broker, paternalistic clan chief. He'll do anything. He'll do anything to protect his clan. Anything.
So that education at Aberdeen was actually quite apt. He put it to good use.
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah, he did. He did. He definitely did. He learned about the law. He learned how to use the law. He learned, as I say, about how to wield power, who to accommodate, who to destroy. He learnt about that brutal side of life, you know. It's not nice power. Power is not love, in a way. Do you know what I mean? I mean, I know that's a cliche, but it is. He is, by this stage, all about keeping power. He loves his people, but it is in this very paternalistic way.
Now, as we see him at this state, or in this state, at the time of the 45, and that is the time, of course, that Outlander, the story of Outlander starts just before that time.
Yeah.
We see him in the story in Dragonfly and Amber in book two, in season two as well, when they go back and visit him, as you said, they go back and visit him to try and garner his support and see, you know, which side is he going to be on, because he's a known double dealer. The 45 happens, of course, and which culminates with Culloden in 46. Simon, of course, decides to support, wink, wink, the 45, and he sends his son, but at the same time that allows him to be both supportive as well as have the ability to say, oh no, I didn't actually approve that, if and when government troops come a knock on to his door. And so we see this double dealing till his end. But he did have an opportunity to meet Bonnie Prince Charlie once he got to Scotland. Simon wasn't very impressed with Bonnie Prince Charlie as far as his war games and plans and tactics. Tell our listeners about that.
Well, just on the point of view of sending his son out and then staying at home himself, I think that is actually an accurate. I can imagine feeling like that. As I said, I've said to you before, I think he's an emotional Jacobite, but a kind of intellectual establishment man by now. So he sends his son out and he stays at home. And all he's really doing there is you're getting a dramatization of that internal turmoil that an awful lot of the clan chiefs are feeling. I want to go, I want to stay, I want to go, I want to stay. And then what happens is, of course, his son goes off and they have the Battle of Preston Pans, which is a fantastic victory for the Jacobites. And when Simon hears about that, he takes off his hat and he throws it into the ring, and that's it. He's going to come all out. He then raises his clan and he will then send them out to fight for Bonnie Prince Charlie. I agree, when Bonnie Prince Charlie arrives, Simon tries to tell him to go home. He is so unimpressed by him arriving with just a few men and some guns. There's no war chest. There's no French invasion plan. There's no proper army. And he just says, he writes to him and says, silver would go far in the Highlands. You've got, I mean, we know how expensive war is. You know, we've all seen war, the wars we've all been involved in on the television. It costs a flippin' fortune, and it did then, and it does now. And he just doesn't believe him. He doesn't believe it's going to happen. But because they do that kind of guerrilla rush, they're not a formal, conventional army. They are a small, nimble, quick-moving guerrilla band. They're out of the Western Highlands, down to Edinburgh, off to Prestonpans, before anyone can blink. And then I think Simon thinks, bloody hell, we're in with a chance here. And they're heading off into England. And he does throw his hat in with him. You know, Bonnie Prince Charlie, people say he was very easy to refuse. She got a letter from him saying, please come and rise for me. But when you met him, apparently he had a lot of charisma. He was irresistible face to face. You know, he was very popular in Edinburgh, but he had some fatal character flaws. And he was, I think, a bit of a lightweight. You know, when he encountered resistance and bad luck, then his weaknesses came to the fore. And I think Simon could pick all of that up quite clearly about him. I mean, he's a very canny man. I think he read people quite well, Simon. And he is supposed to have met him, but that's after Culloden, isn't it? To try and stiffen his backbone, basically, and say, come on, remember your ancestor, Robert the Bruce, defeated three times and then won on the fourth attempt. But Charles Edward's not going to have anything of it by then. He's away.
What would they have had left to fight with?
Well, I think what they would have done, Summer, is they would have retreated. The plan was to retreat into the hills and gather their forces. And again, this hope of foreign backing, of some foreign power putting boots on the ground, France, and to start. And because they'd got so far, because they got as far as Derby, you know, and they got so far so fast. This is one of the big debates over here. You know, it's a slightly what if, you know, could they have won? They could have retreated and gathered their forces and started again. But and not to do so was fatal. I mean, maybe they wouldn't have succeeded. But what they could have done, what historians tend to think they could have done, is held Scotland. You know, if they'd retreated properly, garrisoned Stirling, which is on the west coast of Scotland, Edinburgh on the east, which is a very narrow part of the country there, they could have garrisoned Scotland and held Scotland and maybe forced the breaking of the Union. They might have done that. And he might, Bonnie Prince Charlie, have been crowned king of a newly re-independent Scotland. I mean, probably not. This is just kind of, you know, glass of wine talk, you know, but maybe. We'll see.
Well, in the series, they had the whole moment of after they had the big successes at Prestonpans and the further, they were like, well, why don't we just hold what we have? And he was like, no, I'm not going to be satisfied until my butt's sitting on that English throne that I feel that is supposed to be mine. And it almost felt like the greed. I'm not satisfied with what I have. I always have to have more.
Yeah, and it's like Icarus, isn't it? He is it's the hubris of youth. It's youth. It's that kind of strong but brittle, we're just going to go for it. You know, that idealism, which is not backed up by any level-headed listening to the intelligence. You know, he's got some very experienced men around him in Lord George Murray and so on, and he doesn't listen. No, they spread themselves too thin. Their supply lines are too thin. You know, as they go running off via Carlisle into England, they can't possibly keep it up. The momentum is going to fizzle out at some point. Yeah. Character weaknesses, as I say. It was his personal character weaknesses are a lot to do with how bad the failure was.
So we all know how Culloden ended. And of course, that the defeat itself, the overall defeat, leads to Simon Fraser's capture. I do want to go on and talk about his capture and his final days. Let's pause here a little bit to talk about season three's portrayal of the Battle of Culloden.
Oh, I don't know about you, although I would do a bit because I've seen your podcast. But I mean, I found it agonizing to watch that. Utterly, brutally true and agonizing. And this whole thing of not taking prisoners, you know, of killing men on the battlefield, the pursuit of them afterwards. You know, Cumberland's order was, and the wording is so awful, was to pursue these vermin through their lurking hills. Now, if you are characterizing an entire people as vermin, then do you see what you're putting in the mind of your men? I mean, vermin, you eradicate, don't you? It was absolutely dreadful. It's heartbreaking to watch. And that scene where, oh dear, where they come in and in that cool kind of, I'm afraid you're all going to have to be executed because you're traitors. And that's the sentence, the only sentence for high treason, one after another. You know, it's the clinicalness of it as well. I think it was a terrible time. I mean, the Highlands were, we also read reports, you know, of a man who, for example, John Fraser, who would have been, say, a cousin of Jamie Fraser. John Fraser, who was an officer in Lovett's, was injured on the battlefield. He thought that he would be taken to a field hospital, but then, of course, he saw the executions, basically, the murders on the battlefield. A cart came up and he thought, OK, they've had enough. You know, the bloodlust is sated. And he was thrown into a cart with other people, taken to a little copse near Culloden, and they were all lined up and they were shot. And those who fell mostly died. Those who didn't were then clubbed to death.
Oh,
now, John Fraser had been wounded on the battlefield, thought he'd got away with those on the battlefield executions, taken in a cart and thought, maybe I'm being saved again. He'd then escaped another serious attempt to kill him. And he lived. The reason we know this happened is he lived to tell the tale to a man called Bishop Forbes. And he lost an eye and had broken bones, but he lived. So, I know that happened. And when I saw the filming of it and the emotional agony of it. It was, I found it really awful to watch, really terrible. What did you too, I guess? I know you did, you must have done. It was terrible.
Seeing them up against, I've likened it to them fighting with sticks and stones against people with, you know, weapon grade machine guns. I mean, it was like just them, just the lines of them being just cut down one after another and just continuing to run at them. It was really hard to watch. It was quite a way to open the season.
Yeah,
but,
I agree.
You know, it was visually very difficult to watch.
Yeah, I thought it was. It was intensely dramatic and sadly accurate. And you're right, the whole waste of it, them just charging down when they should never have met. I mean, that's another mess of Bonnie Prince Charlie. They should not have joined battle where they did, when they did. And it was a carve up. And that was really just the beginning. But I mean, if we've been talking about these Jacobite rebellions, and it has been the biggest single security threat to this growing British state. With Stuarts off the throne, Stuarts on the throne, Hanoverians in, resistance to them. And they had had these series of rebellions and they just thought, never, never again. This is not going to happen again. And vengeance, they took vengeance because they had disturbed the peace of this state. It was really, I thought, very painful. Oh, dear.
It was. And I think the whenever I watch or have seen the number of times I've seen episode one with the opening of the battle, obviously it's very it's dramatic. It's sad. It's devastating. But it's not that we didn't know it was coming. We knew it was coming. When Summer and I went to Comic-Con this year, there was in the schedule, it said, oh, it's an hour and a half. And a lot of people took that as a sign that, oh, we're going to get they're going to show us the premiere. They're going to show us episode one, but nothing. Of course, they're not going to announce it, and it's never guaranteed. We were hoping. And so we get there, and this is in like third week of July. And they start it. They have the panel, and then they end the panel really quickly, and they show us episode one. And we were in a room with about 5,000 people, 4,000 to 5,000 people. And of course, it goes black, and they had the huge screens, the screenings, like movie screens, to show this on. Imagine as it comes up, like you see the intro to the show that we love, but imagine this opening from blackness, this black room, darkness opening onto this battle scene. And it was a surprise that, oh my gosh, we actually get to see it. This is awesome. To, oh my gosh, I know what they're going to show us. And this is awful. Yeah. And we're going to see it huge. It is in your face. And you know what? It is. Oh, so well done. It's so dramatic. And I think it has to be. You have to understand that there was, because of the choice that was made for the troops, there was no chance. They may have had a chance if other decisions had been made, as you said. But this, there was no chance. And a lot of people, including myself, forget that it's not just the Jacobite army that had a really good, or didn't have a very good chance, or that were a certain type of fighter or whatever. It wasn't just like where they were at that moment and the bad decision to charge or to go forward at that battle. It is that, but it's also, and this is, I think, what you were alluding to. They had just the night before marched to Nairn and back.
Yeah. Exhausted.
Oh my, these people were starving. They were freezing. It was like light snow. It was freezing. Yeah. And they had marched how many miles? Twice.
Yeah. Yeah. It's about 15 miles, 15 miles each way.
Oh my God. They needed like a week's rest.
Yeah. Yeah. They sure did. Oh, it was a massacre. It was a massacre. And you know, and it went on afterwards. I agree with you. I mean, to feel what, of course, that gives you is you're emotionally engaged with it as well, because we're engaged with the personal story. It matters to us. These people matter to us. And when one after another, oh, I can hardly speak about it, they're led out to be killed, you think, oh God, no, you know, don't. Can we not stop this? It was awful. I mean, it was brilliant. I agree. It's so well done. I mean, I hope it wins a prize because it was very, very well done. But that is how it was. And it traumatized the whole region. And then when it went on in this next episode, which has just aired over here, I watched it this morning. That too, I found equally charged. I mean, for example, the Jamie's so traumatized in this, and you have every conviction that you know exactly why he is completely traumatized by what he's just been through, and by the loss of Claire, of course. But that's a sort of numbness, that shock that is on him, and the Highlands were put under military occupation. You know, there were garrisons and they were there to pacify them. And some of our historians have called it, one historian called it genocide, and another one said, no, it's not that bad, but it was ethnic cleansing and war crimes were committed up here. And even by 1750, one of the news sheets in London, they were beginning to get anxious about what had been happening in the Highlands after Culloden, and somebody called for a public inquiry into the Neronian atrocities. You know, the Emperor Nero, who was obscenely evil and destructive and destroyed Rome, that's what they said, that was the phrase, they want an inquiry, a public inquiry into the Neronian atrocities that have gone on in the Highlands. And they were, you know, it's the way prisoners were treated as well. If you were taken in, you were put into some building. Of course, they took their churches, their Gallic churches. The prisoners were thrown in, and any doctors among them were forbidden to treat the wounded. They were put into, prison hulks lying in the Firth outside Inverness. 157 went into one of those, and only 46 came out. It's harrowing reading what happened. And I've spent the last two episodes on the verge of tears. I don't know about you, but just kind of, you know, wanting it to stop, but not being able to take your eyes off it because it's so brilliant.
I won't say the benefits, but one of the results of those clearances, of that cleansing, was how many people, prisoners included, were sent to the colonies, both in the American colonies as well as Australia. So there are now huge, and that's not the only people that traveled. We understand that, but that's a good number, a good reason for for the numbers of Scots in those areas, and they settled. And of course, now we have a lot of people can say that that's their lineage now. In present day. But something that, it's not that I don't believe it, I definitely believe it. I believe the material, I believe the writing, but I've traveled throughout the Highlands of Scotland, and I by no means have been everywhere, of course not. But when I read in your book and I read other accounts that by no means a metropolis or an area of metropolises, the Highlands were thriving and filled with people. But now, and it like gives me like this, you know, it's like when you look at the way it was, that cleansing, that those clearances were done, treated absolutely as vermin. And you look at, just go through the Highlands today. And if you're lucky, and I do say lucky, I mean that, you might find an old ruin of a cottar or a cottage. Yeah. You might find some stones that were once, you know, someone's home. Yeah. But how can you reconcile that for a modern day visitor to the Highlands who loves Scotland, who wants to see it and appreciate its beauty, and, you know, takes the train or a drive or whatever through the Highlands? It is my favorite place on earth, Scotland. It is the home of my heart. But to see barren, not in like a wasteland, but barren of people, it was not always like that. Can you bring that across to the listener, just how thriving the Highlands were?
Well, oh yes. I mean, I've walked through woods and you can see whole townships. Not just, I agree, they're absolutely down to the bare bones. There's just rubble on the ground. It's skeletons. It's like an elephant's graveyard, these places. But you go in and you can see where the cottages were. You know, that village that appears, those villages that appear in series one particularly, you see the ruins of whole villages like that. And Strathfara, which is the glen, it's really the Lovat heartland. It's the glen that goes away from Inverness, Bewley, Beaufort Castle, up towards the west. It connects the east coast and west coast traditional clan territories. There were 500 people living up there. The bottom of the Strath is very fertile, and there are 16 today, you know, and that kind of thing. And that happened in two stages. One, there was the forced emigration of people after Culloden, being sent as indentured labour, as slaves effectively, to the West Indies or to South Carolina or Virginia. But then about a century later, where are we? So, no, not that long, actually, 74, about 70 years later, and it started as early as 1776, the landlords themselves, they turned from being chiefs to being British landlords. And suddenly you didn't need kin, you didn't need clansmen. What you needed was animals that were going to generate capital, because the Highlands is not a cash-based economy traditionally. It's all based on what they call gion. Gion, D-I-O-N, is the concept of protection, mutual succor and support. And so an old chief like Lovat of the 45 would, half his rents, as you can see on, you know, on those rent days that they have in the series, rents come in all shapes and sizes. They're not just little round coins. They're on four legs, chewing and buying and pooing, and their cheeses under your arm. And half of that, yes, would be sold for cash for the estate, but half of it would be kept to be redistributed in times of hardship in the winter or during a famine, a bad harvest. And so that principle of mutual care was completely destroyed. They wanted to break that link between the Highland people and the chief. And they did it so successfully in this period following Culloden that the chiefs became landlords, not chiefs. And landlords want to work their land and get money. And they cleared the people. And that is the Highland clearances that we also remember. So the Highlands suffered two brutal blows to its culture and society from which it has struggled to survive, really. I'm not sure about recover, just survive.
To link it back to Simon Fraser, he is now on the losing side.
Yeah.
And it's time to pay the piper.
Yeah.
How was he captured? And ultimately, what was his end?
In the end, I think once they found he wasn't difficult to capture because he was sold, he couldn't move fast. And a lot of the Jacobite leadership, like Bonnie Prince Charlie, slipped the net. And the government needed what we would call today high-value targets. And they really needed somebody like Lovat. And he had been carried in a litter by his kinsmen over up through Strathfara to the west coast. And he was hiding at the edge of a loch on the west coast called Loch Mora. And government men of war, two particularly, the Furness and the Terror, tells you all about what they're for, doesn't it? They were nosing in and out of the West Coast looking for Jacobites trying to get away. They principally wanted Bonnie Prince Charlie and that Jacobite military elite, but most of them escaped. But they were after Lovat, and there was a price on his head, and they got him. They basically came across him because he couldn't run away from them. And they captured him and took him on board one of these men of war. And they took him to Fort William initially, and that's on the west coast. And then they started bringing him east to Fort Augustus. And Cumberland was delighted. He was thrilled to have got Lovat because, as he said, he ranks so high in command and has so many titles and is so well esteemed up here. They thought that he could never be caught, that he had such knowledge of the terrain that we could never get him. So they talked up what a great achievement it was to catch him. And once they got him, they were not going to let him go. He became their main prize. And he was taken slowly south up the Great Glen of Loch Ness. And his people turned out and they started keening and wailing, this old-fashioned way of grieving the loss of your chief. And it must have been very weird for Lovat because he's being carried in a litter by now and he's almost like a preemptive ghost at his own funeral. You know, they're wailing and keening for him as if he's already dead, really. He's taken to Edinburgh. By then, his son's been captured. So he can't see his boy, but they're both in prison in Edinburgh Castle. And he's then taken to London and locked up in the Tower of London. And they keep him there for 10 months, for nearly a year, while they try and gather evidence against him. The newspapers call him the Great Leviathan. There's a real sense of, it's rather like when they got, you know, Osama bin Laden, you know, it's hooray, the whole thing, we really have won. It's a marker of your victory. So they called him the Great Leviathan and said the government has hooked the jaws of the Great Leviathan and they're going to reel him in and they're not going to let him go. And in the end, they have to try him in some form and he's impeached by his peers in Westminster Hall. And it must have been an awful thing for him because, you know, he's surrounded by Scottish and English lords and peers who he's known most of his life and they know him. And a lot of them, even his old enemy Argyll, thinks, oh, this is too much. You know, they're baiting the old bear kind of thing. And all the peers, one by one, the hundreds of them, have to pronounce him guilty upon my honour. And then he is sentenced to be hung, drawn and quartered, which is an obscene death and the king commutes that to a beheading. And on the 9th of April, which is a Thursday in 1747, he is taken out and he is beheaded. And he says, you know, dulce et decorum est pro patria mori. It is sweet and seemly to die for your country. And I think what he meant by that was an independent Scotland. And he was enormously dignified. Jamie Fraser would have been proud of him in death if he wasn't very proud of him in life, on the scaffold. And even Lovat's enemies, one of them who was in London to see it, it was one of the events of the season. Thousands turned out to watch it, his beheading. He wrote home and said, you know, old Lovat died today. And though he may have lived like a fox, he died like a lion, and as a Highland chief should. That is, not in his bed. I think that's tremendous. Slightly chokes me up to say it. Sorry, Ginger. Sorry, Summer. And it was...
No,
it was,
that's all right. The whole topic and the whole discussion of the battle and onward and up to his end is very... It chokes one up. Mm. It does. It's very poignant and very sad. Mm. And... in the bleakness, in the tragedy of everything that had happened and the hopelessness that was in his homeland, that he had no power over the fact that he was going to die, but he had power over how he was hold himself to the end. And that is, I think, a great legacy.
Amen to that. That is true. I think, yeah, that's absolutely... He's a worthy grandfather for our hero, don't you think?
Oh, goodness. I think so. Absolutely. You've taken us on an incredible journey from the beginning and the beginning of Jacobitism up till basically the end of Jacobitism.
Mm. Yeah.
I think that was the final nail in the coffin of that. Mm. And we, of course, will continue to watch season 3 and and we surmise that you probably will too.
Oh, yeah.
But what an honor it's been to speak with you, not just a Fraser in your own right, but also historian and someone who was so moved by what their children were learning that you figured, look, someone's got to do it, so I'm going to do it, and took it upon yourself to learn Gaelic. And look where it's gone. It's an amazing... Your life is an amazing journey.
Well, yes. Yeah, it has been interesting. You never know where it's going to lead you, you know, because I have, as you said at the beginning, I have to come clean. I have married two Frasers, not one. I am a twice married outlander. I mean, you know, there's some horrible parallels here, or rather they're lovely parallels. And I bred four of them and wrote about another one and Lovat at the 45. And, it's a hell of a life, actually. And that, but my beautiful, beautiful second husband's had a horrible stroke, so I'm now a carer as well. So life is so rich. It's not always good or easy, but it is an incredibly rich thing, that's for sure.
I had a question about the writing of the book. Do you feel that you, or do you know that you had access to things that other historians might not have, being that you were coming at it from the family side?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think I give him a fair hearing. I mean, I won a Saltire Prize in Edinburgh, and the man who was giving it to me said, you know, great book, I loved it, but oh, what a rogue, you know. And I just thought, yeah, but he's family, you know, and there's a way in which you just put up with family and you kind of try and understand them before you judge them, you know. And also, yes, of course, I mean, I could get all the material, I could get all the sort of books and manuscripts and things like that, and his handwriting, and you can always tell when he's in trouble, his handwriting just falls apart. Mm. I mean, it's just, when he's obviously galloping away from some awful mess he's just created, you can hardly read what he's saying.
I remember you mentioned handwriting. I remember I studied just 1 year, but I was at the University of St. Andrews and doing a course, early medieval Scottish history. And of course, we studied Latin and paleography. And that was when I was first introduced to paleography. And we did mostly early
early, so Latin, looked at the manuscripts in Latin, like charters and such, and only were barely introduced into more of the later secretary hands. But I remember, even though my Latin is very bad, I remember looking at those, and for an assignment, I would always go to the Latin, because trying to read those more, or the early modern, or the modern scripts, even in English or Scots, oh my gosh, how did you have a specific support in that?
Crikey, yes, the coffee machine. No, it was...
the coffee machine.
Yeah, it is, yeah. I mean, it's terrible. And also spelling has not stabilized.
Yep.
So, you know, they might spell the same thing several different ways. Spelling was awful. And punctuation. Punctuation is just kind of a... well, it's whatever I feel like, you know. I'll put a full stop here or I won't, you know. Can't you hear me breathing, you know, as I write this? Oh dear. No, but you get the real voice. You do get the, you know, once you get into the handwriting, you get the voice, because, you know, you get someone like Lovett who is talking about, say, planning something political to do with the Jacobites. And then at the same time, he'll suddenly put in a paragraph of, but I'm rather distracted because my boy was playing a Halloween game in front of the fire the other night, and a log fell out and burned his leg. And I can't think of anything except whether he's going to be scarred, et cetera, et cetera. Do you see what I mean? You suddenly get those domestic moments, or he's been ill, or, you know, he's a bit bunged up and someone's given him rhubarb, you know, which has sorted him out, you know, and you just suddenly you get this mixture of domestic detail and his health worries. And also, how are we going to have a revolution? And it's you do get those in the letters.
Oh, my goodness. Well, this has been so entertaining. And it's just I could go on for much longer talking about this fascinating historical character. I'm glad you mentioned the handwriting, though, because when it's someone from the, like, maybe someone from the mid, early, if you're lucky, 20th century, we'd want to look at home movies. We'd want to look at, you know, things that had that spark of life, them on an image or in a moving picture. There's no choice about that in the 18th century. Having someone's handwriting is I think the closest thing. I think even maybe closer than a painting or an engraving, because that's the person, it's not someone else's depiction of them. So I think it so humanizes them.
It does indeed. Yeah. And I've enjoyed speaking with you two as well. And I mean, I'm coming over next year because I've got this book and another book to publicize, and I'm going to do some talks. So I hope we meet. I hope we meet at some conference, or it would be very nice. I am very much looking forward to coming over.
No, that would be fantastic. And if you have, you said you mentioned another book. If there's ever the opportunity to speak with you about that, that would be delightful.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It'd be a pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me to speak.
Oh, no, it's been our pleasure. So thank you, Dr. Sarah Fraser, for joining us here on the Outlander podcast. We cannot wait for our listeners and friends to hear about this fascinating man who was both fox and lion.
Yes, indeed. Thank you for saying that.
We hope you've enjoyed our interview with Dr. Sarah Fraser. To continue the conversation, as always, we invite you to our Facebook community. And that's at outlanderpod.com/group. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.